President Winthy graduated from Effington High School in South Central Illinois in 1962. After attending Concordia College, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, he received the Bachelor of Arts with distinction from Concordia Senior College here at Fort Wayne, Indiana. His seminary training was done at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri, and Princeton Theological Seminary, Princeton, New Jersey. After returning to the seminary from the parish ministry in 1980, he earned advanced degrees at the University of Notre Dame, Notre Dame, Indiana, in Hebrew scriptures with minors in Judaica and ethics. Now I know why they had me introduce you. My natural nemesis. I went to University of Southern California, that's why I said that. Dr. Winthy was called to Concordia Theological Seminary, Springfield, Illinois, as an instructor and then assistant professor of Old Testament from 1971 to 1977. While in Springfield, he served as an Air Force chaplain in the reserves. In 1977, he was accepted to a call in Zion Lutheran Church, Atlantic, Iowa, and served as pastor for 3 years. He returned to the seminary in 1980 as an associate professor of Old Testament. While at the seminary, he served vacancies at Emmanuel Lutheran Church, Wayne Trace, Indiana, and Zion Lutheran Church, Garrett, Indiana. He also served as pastoral assistant at Emmanuel Lutheran Church, New Haven, Indiana, from 1989 to 1996. On April 28, 1996, Dr. Winthy was installed as the seminary's 15th president. President Winthy has delivered papers at numerous conferences and written articles for various theological journals. He was an associate editor of the Concordia Self-Study Bible. He presently serves as the general editor of the Concordia Commentary. Dr. Winthy and his wife, Linda, have been blessed with 4 sons, Timothy, Matthew, Joel, and Joshua. Please welcome me in introducing our 15th president, President Dean O. Winthy.
Thank you, Bill. It's a great pleasure to be with you this afternoon and to look at sacred scripture together, to enter the world of the Old Testament. Let me just begin by saying that it's a great pleasure to return to my first love, which is the Bible. And what I'd like to do today is look very broadly and kind of reflect on the Old Testament. If I'm out in the church and I ask a group of laity, what do you think of when you think of the Old Testament? One of the reactions that periodically comes up is Charlton Heston and the old movie of the Exodus, you know. So Yul Brynner is the Pharaoh and Charlton Heston is Moses. And I suspect that in many ways that's the way the Old Testament comes across, the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. I'd like to spend just a little time with some key texts and talk about God's gracious character in the Old Testament, a gracious character that wants to reach out to all the world. And as we do so, periodically we'll have some artwork that we're going to share. But let me begin at the very beginning, namely Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. If you look at the present artwork, this is an overview from Moses on of some of the great prophets, Isaiah, Habakkuk, down Jesus, Paul, Luther, around the theme of justification. And of course, one of the great solas of the Reformation, sola gratia, is a function of justification. That is, we are justified freely by God's grace. Now, we'll leave this slide up for a while because I want to start in the very beginning. And as I do so, I knew that you would all enjoy learning a bit of Hebrew. Isn't that, I can see it in your eyes, that would make your afternoon more complete. And if you look at Genesis 1 and 2, the first thing we notice is how God gives. He gives, in fact, the whole world. He creates the heavens and the earth. He establishes the seasons, all that man and woman might have the ideal setting. And so I thought you'd enjoy learning the Hebrew word for man and the Hebrew word for woman. The Hebrew word for man, and this occurs in the second chapter of Genesis, where Adam had been naming cocker spaniels and giraffes, and he said, "Lord, there's nothing here that looks very appealing." And so you'll recall how God causes a sleep to fall on Adam and he creates woman, and that's then the first poetry of the Old Testament. "This at last," Adam cries out, "is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She will be called woman, for she's taken from the man." Now, the word for man in Hebrew is ish. Can you say that? Ish. Very good. I think you get at least a B+. Ish. Let's say it again. Ish. Now, the word for woman is isha. Can you say that? Isha. Very good. So, the difference between man, ish, and this is actually the way the Hebrew reads, ish, and the word for woman, isha, is Now, you have entered into the beauty and the wonder of the Old Testament. And that I want to dwell upon, because the first two chapters are sometimes, talked about simply in terms of creation and evolution and those debates. And that's legitimate, but if you look at the text, 1 Genesis 1, over and over in those verses, the opening verses, God looks at everything and he says, "This is good." The Hebrew word there is tov. In fact, you did so well, you probably want to know how to say good morning in Hebrew. Tov is good. Boker is morning, so good morning is boker tov. Can you say that? Boker tov. How many want to sign up for Hebrew at the seminary? I mean, this is now when you take a trip to Israel, you know how to say good morning. But the goodness of creation is something that we need to reflect upon, because as God created the heavens and the earth, and the animals, the seas, the seasons, what is so striking is his repeated announcement, he saw that it was good. And that's significant because in the context that Moses wrote in, many of the features of this world were already seen as opponents of human beings. In Egypt, where Moses wrote, and in Mesopotamia, where Abraham came from, people had worshipped the sun, the moon, the stars, and they had worshipped them in great fear. The literature of Mesopotamia and of Egypt is full of epics that describe the activity of the gods as very important, and the role of man and woman as very marginal. Men and women in those epics are seen as simple pawns, subject to the caprice and the ill will of the gods. So that in the Holy Land itself, the god that rose to prominence there is called Baal. And there was a whole system of sacrifice to Baal, trying to placate him so that he would bless the earth with rain and so that there would be food for the next year. So in the context that Israel found itself and Moses wrote in, the forces of nature were seen as great threats because behind them were seen deities. Genesis 1 removes those dark forces. In fact, you'll recall when God creates the moon and the sun, he does it simply as a servant of the seasons so that men and women might prosper. It's a remarkable text when it's put in the context of Moses. And what it does, and this is a wonderful expression of God's gracious, caring character, is it opens up for human beings God's loving will. That is, that he intended all these things to be the servant of man and woman. Indeed, one of the features of chapter 1 of Genesis is that in Semitic literature, the most important element in a string of events is usually placed at the end. And Moses, writing out of that context, places the creation of man and woman at the end to indicate that this is the apex of creation. Everything that preceded was leading up to this wonderful place that and wonderful creation of man and woman. Indeed, what is striking, after God has ordered the whole world, you'll recall in chapter 1, verse 26 and following, where God says in his own reflection, "Now let us make man in our own image and in our own likeness." So not only does God give of himself in creating a great world, but he gives of himself in making us in his image and in his likeness. Now I'd like to immediately say that if you go to our culture, there are understandings of the world that do just the opposite of what Genesis 1 does. If you've ever heard the astronomer Carl Sagan speak, or some of the scientific community, they talk about man and woman, not unlike the religions of Mesopotamia and Egypt, as simply accidental species, that eventually, in their view, human beings will be gone like the dinosaurs. We're just a little blip on the evolutionary trail. Genesis chapter 1 challenges that because it says that instead of being marginal and accidental, man and woman are at the very center of God's creative plan. And indeed that the world goes on for our sake. And I'd invite you to read through that again as you go home and think about how giving and gracious God is in the opening chapter. And then beyond that, if you go to chapter 2, which is still before the fall into sin, there is a wonderful intimacy about the way God addresses Adam, the way he positions him in the Garden of Eden. It's located just south of Fort Wayne, Indiana, around Decatur, I think. Think about how carefully God orchestrates and positions man and woman. It's a wonderful portrait. And sometimes we miss the richness of it. The way in which God breathes into man and woman the breath of life. It's called the Ruach Hayim, the breath of life, gives him a soul. And in those first two chapters, everything is perfect. There is utter and complete innocence. That sets the stage for the whole Old Testament. And it's a very different God if you start with Genesis 1 and 2 than if you start with Exodus 20, where God is giving the law from Sinai. One of the mistaken simplifications of the Old Testament is that God is an angry, demanding God in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, he's a gracious and forgiving God. In fact, he's a gracious and forgiving and holy God in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And what grounds his mission is this wonderful giving character that we see already in Genesis 1 and 2. Indeed, I like to ask, you know, have any of you ever had a perfect day? Where your mind was clear, your body was healthy, you had no anxiety, no bad thoughts crossed your mind, your husband or your wife was perfectly obedient, kind, generous. I'm sure, you know, Lutherans have lots of those days, huh? It's, in fact, living from our perspective in a fallen order, we have to be careful when we're crossing the street. We have to be careful when we step down steps. There are all kinds of challenges simply to live a normal life. In the first two chapters of Genesis, everything was perfect. And how then have we arrived at this state where people see the God of the Old Testament as less than the gracious and merciful Father of Jesus Christ? Well, let me try to look a little bit at how this devolved. And if we could have our second slide. This is an indication that here comes the serpent down, and you can see the apples there. They're from California. Where many temptations come from. And then could we have the next slide, please? You see here the terrible reversal that occurred in this classic rupture where Adam and Eve now, who were perfectly at home with God and communing with God, now flee from God. And then one more. This is how Adam feels now. Eve has just told him what a mess he's made of things, and you can see it's not good. What happened? And people have even asked from the beginning, why did God give this capacity to human beings to mess things up? The nearest, I think, that a satisfactory answer can be found is from a commentary by St. Augustine. And I'd like to share that because St. Augustine says that it was a matter of love, that God loved man and woman so deeply that he wanted to give them free will. That is, that he wanted them to love him freely from their heart and not be limited to him, but to have free choice. You know, it's like when our teenage sons were considering dating someone, if I say, whatever you do, don't date that girl, I was almost certain they would ask her out. There's something about that. And the love that God displayed in giving man and woman such free will is a mystery, but it's a beautiful mystery. Let me use another analogy. When our boys, and this happened to all of them unfortunately, turned 16, it wasn't too long until they'd say, Dad, can I have the car? That's a real moment of anxiety, because I remember when I was 16 and asked for the keys. And at that point, you know, a parent might say, well, wait until you're 24. But most would say that's really not the most loving thing. You hope you've built in some character, and so slowly you get out the oh, here are the keys. And you pray vigorously through the night. And what a joy it is when the vehicle returns safely. Well, I think it's an analogy that limps, but there is something that Augustine's trying to get at there, that finally God gave Adam and Eve the keys, as it were. He trusted, and everything should have gone the right way so that Adam not end up in this position. But of course, there was this one temptation to be like God. Satan came in a very vulnerable time and moment, and that was the temptation that did it. And so across our existence, what was good became difficult. Our communion with God was broken. Now Adam runs when he hears God coming, and God has to say, Adam, where are you? And one of the old patristic scholars said the reason God asked, where are you, wasn't because he needed to know where Adam was, but that Adam needed to know where he was. He had drifted from that innocence and holiness now to a state of being curved in upon himself and choosing himself over his creatureliness before God. And if you'll recall, not only the communion with God was problematic, but now the communion within the human family was problematic. Remember when God says to Adam, why did you do this? What was his explanation? Well, it's the woman. She gave me to eat, and you gave me her. Now, that would never happen in Lutheran families, would it, that a spouse would blame the other spouse? But that's a breaking of the human fellowship, and then the fracture of relationship to creation. Now God says creation will bring forth thorns and thistles in chapter 3. And finally, there is a fracture within Adam and Eve themselves. Now they do not know who they are. And it's only in God's gracious promise, immediately after the fall in Genesis 3:15, he comes and says, behold, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He will crush your head and you will bruise his heel, which I believe is the first promise of Jesus. The seed of the woman, there is Jesus. In fact, if you look at the Hebrew, this is the only place in the Old Testament where the word for seed, zerah, has a feminine suffix, zerah-ah, that same ah that was on isha, so that Luther thought, and I agree with him, that already the virgin birth was prophesied because Jesus would be uniquely the seed of the woman. Now, again, that shows that even after man and woman have rejected all of God's gifts and all of his grace, he does not give up. In chapter 3, he promises this seed. In chapter 4, verse 1, Eve says, I have gotten a man, the Lord. She thought already in her first birth that this was the deliverer that was promised in chapter 3. And as you go through the book of Genesis, it's an unveiling of a gracious God who gives and gives and gives his promises. And in response, the people tragically choose themselves. So that in chapter 4, Cain, the second person who's born, kills Abel. There's a fratricide already in chapter 4. And then at the end of chapter 4 says, God, to Adam and Eve, I'm going to give you another seed to replace Abel. And so Seth is born. And then very quickly through chapter 5 is genealogies. Chapter 6, there is a terrible situation of violence. And God finally says, this is it. I'm going to create a new order. I'll send the flood. And Noah, it is said, and his family find grace. That's the first time that the Hebrew word for grace occurs. They find grace. Their ark becomes the vessel by which God now leads people forward towards the Messiah. And from the end of the flood, the flood is in Genesis 6 to 9. From the end, the story picks up with the blessing of Noah of Ham, Shem, and Japheth. That's the ELCA, the Wisconsin Synod, and the Missouri Synod. Not really. But I think you can see in that blessing, the blessing falls to Shem, which is the wonderful now way to find the way to the Messiah. And then Abraham is blessed. Jacob is blessed. So you have throughout Genesis repeated blessings. And Genesis began with a blessing, and it ends with the blessing of Judah in chapter 49, verse 8 and following. So if you step back and look at the first book of the Bible, Genesis, the character of God is a gracious God who's reaching out to a people who've continually said no, but he keeps reaching and he keeps blessing. It's a wonderful, wonderful account. In fact, I'll just dwell on one facet of that text for a moment. Is you'll recall when Abraham receives the promise that in your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed, a wonderful continuation of the promise of Jesus. That occurs in chapter 12, 1 to 3. He then goes down to Egypt. There's a drought in the land and a famine. And when he comes to Egypt, Pharaoh sees Sarah and says, she's such a beautiful woman. I'd like to invite her into my harem. And what does Abram say? She's my wife. You can't in any way invite her over. No, Abram's afraid and says, she's my sister. Now, how could he be a Lutheran and do that? He was a very human being, wasn't he? And finally, God had to intervene, caused all kind of trouble in Pharaoh's household to protect the virtue of Sarah, and Pharaoh quickly returns her. So you get in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob these glimpses that they're people just like we are. They had their weaknesses, even though they were blessed also with great faith. And if you read the narrative of Abraham from chapter 12, he has to wait over and over and over for the birth of Isaac. God kept promising him a son, promising a son. He's well over 80, and there's still no son, and Sarah's getting older. And it's only in chapter 21 that then Isaac is born. In chapter 22, God says, go and offer up Isaac as a sacrifice. So one can see the incredible faith of Abraham. In fact, in chapter 22, when he's going out with Isaac, Isaac says, Father, where is the sacrifice? We have the wood, his father responds, God will provide. And when God tells him to take Isaac and sacrifice, and he says, take Isaac, your only son, whom you love. So you see, Abram's faith stands out with very great clarity. And God provided that innocent lamb so that Isaac could go on and be the father of the Messiah. If you go to the very end of Genesis, chapter 50, verses 19 and 20 are very interesting because It's a reflection on Joseph, by Joseph with his brothers. His brothers come and say, we apologize, we sold you into slavery, and we will be your slaves. He refuses that offer and says, what you did, you intended evil, but God intended good to save the lives of many. So you have there the beauty of Genesis shown again. God is giving. He's preserving, in this case, the whole tribe of Israel by seeing that in the great famine that Joseph was in the office of Pharaoh's court, and he was able to provide for the Jews, and indeed they settled in the land of Goshen and flourished there, which was why a later Pharaoh felt threatened by them. Now, I wanted to just paint in a few other of these great gracious moments and highlight them for you, because if you go from Genesis to Exodus, there again, you see how God beautifully provides for the deliverance of his people. The call of Moses is chapters 1 through 3. Then you have a series of plagues leading up to the greatest plague, which is the Passover lamb in chapter 12. And then finally Pharaoh relents, and in chapters 14 and 15 you have the Exodus. And then as after they're into the desert, you have this beautiful text about the creation of the tabernacle, chapters 24 to 40 of Exodus. And I think it's safe to say that Lutherans haven't spent a lot of time studying the tabernacle. That is a very central place, though, for Moses to let God's grace be seen, because right at the end of 40, after all the construction of the tabernacle, it says God's glory came and dwelt there. So that people had, as it were, a sacramental presence of God in that tabernacle. And there was a pillar of fire by night, a pillar of cloud by day, and it was all intended to be their gracious deliverance. God was showing them that he was truly present. And so at the very heart of the Old Testament's first book, the Torah, is this gracious presence of God with his people. And immediately in Leviticus, you have the sacrificial system set up so that sinful people might not be terrorized by coming to the real presence of God. That is, they knew that their sins were atoned for because of the sacrifices. And those sacrifices, as the book of Hebrews tells us, pointed forward to God's grace, gracious acts in Christ and his gracious deliverance. So far from the Old Testament being simply empty ritual, it's worship that is meaningful because it's joined to God's gracious presence. And that is a freeing way to look at the character of our Father. That is the Father of Jesus Christ. His character does not change from Old Testament to New Testament. In fact, I'd invite you to reflect on this. The last book of the Pentateuch, or the Torah, the first book of the Bible, is Deuteronomy. It ends on a wonderful note of blessing. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 28, 1 and following, you have a whole series of blessings upon the people as they're about to enter the land, so that the God who gave it creation gives himself to the people in promise, he gives himself to the people in presence, and now he gives the people a blessing. And the blessing, of course, is tied to their being his people. The gospel is there, the promise of God's gracious presence. Indeed, Deuteronomy 33 talks about the blessing of Moses, and the land of Israel was to become a new Eden, So at the beginning, God gave place, the Garden of Eden. At the end of the Pentateuch, he gives them the land flowing with milk and honey, on which the Messiah is to be born, who will reverse this terrible curse. What that does is, I think, cast the Old Testament in the same dynamic as the New Testament. The Old Testament was not, God gave us the law, and if we are just obedient, we'll be saved. That's how some think about it. But it's precisely like the New Testament. In the Old Testament, God gave himself and expected that we would respond to his gracious character. And as the disciples with Jesus, the response wasn't adequate at first. There was much that was wrong. And throughout the Old Testament, you see how the majority of Israel chose other gods or themselves over God's gracious offer. But he continues to offer over and over and over. And that offer isn't just to the people of Israel. It's to all the nations. It's to all who will believe in the seed. And we'll look at some of those texts in a moment. Let me pause here and kind of frame an analogy. I had an uncle whom I grew very fond of. He died at a young age of polio. But I remember up until age 7, I would visit him almost weekly. And now here's a very difficult question. Wink your left eye if yes, and your right eye if the answer is no. I won't ask you to put up your hands, but how many can remember when you could buy a bottle of Coca-Cola for $1? Well, I see a few eyes going down. I mean, that's how far I go back. I don't know. I can't believe it sometimes, but I can remember that because when Uncle Art would, he'd always take me on his lap and we'd visit and he smiled. And every time I went there, just about the time I was leaving, he'd give me a nickel. I loved him with absolute devotion because sometimes even on the way home, I would stop at Nuxel's grocery and get that Coke. Oh, it's heavenly. At home, we got Coke about once a month. And with Uncle Art, I could get it weekly. I mean, life is good if you can have a Coke back then. Well, my affection was a response to his gracious giving. And that's precisely how God's character emerges in the Old Testament. Over and over to a weak and wandering people, he extends his promises, his invitations, and this wonderful giving that is to culminate in the gift of the Messiah. But in the midst of that, he gives them different images to see the Messiah. And before we leave that Pentateuch, which I'm trying to suggest for your consideration, that the Pentateuch and the first book of the Bible is really gospel. It's not Charlton Heston and the law, but it is the gospel pointing to Jesus that predominates. And then we are, God invites us out of his character to respond accordingly. I would have never done something against the will of my Uncle Art. I just couldn't have thought of it at that age. And so when God gives us so much, we should be glad to do the Ten Commandments because of the character of the God who has given them to us. He says, these are good things for you to do, to live uprightly, to honor the Sabbath day, to have no other gods before. These are blessings. They are not saying no to good things, but to bad things that will be harmful to you. And before we leave that first wonderful book of the Bible, I wanted to dwell a little bit on its very last chapter, Deuteronomy 34, which holds up the role of Moses. And if you go to the New Testament, Paul says that Moses was a type, a model of Jesus. And there are good types. You know, Jack said several things about my golf swing yesterday. He didn't say I look like Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus, and I doubt if there's any resemblance between my swing and theirs. But what the Old Testament holds up is people who were pointing to Jesus by their very careers. And let me show how that works. In Deuteronomy chapter 34, the author says that there has not arisen a prophet like Moses who saw God face to face, panim el panim, and did such wonders, mighty works, before all the people. So that in Deuteronomy chapter 18, God promises one day in the future, I will lift up a prophet like Moses. So what you get is this promise. There will be a deliverer, a great prophet, greater than Moses. He'll be like Moses. And then in chapter 34, it says Moses was so great because he had this intimate communion with God, and he did such mighty deeds. And of course, that's precisely what made Jesus stand out, his miracles and the intimate communion that he had with God. Remember on the Mount of Transfiguration, he is talking there with Moses and Elijah, the two pinnacles of Old Testament prophecy, and they both pointed to Jesus, the final and greatest prophet. In fact, you'll recall that when Moses came down from the mountain of God, people could not look at him because his face shone. The presence of God was so illuminating. In the transfiguration account, when Jesus comes down from the mountain, his face shines, and there is this luminous character. So not only are the events and the narratives pointing to God's gracious character, but the individuals like Moses. I might add that when you turn 40, as I did a while back, your friends might have a surprise party, as the faculty did for me. At that time, I had no leverage over them whatsoever. Since becoming president, they're much kinder. But in that moment, they gave me all sorts of things, Geritol, some false teeth, and other things that I'd rather not mention to keep my body going. And I thought after such harassment that we needed a spiritual lift and a text to lift their vision. So I pointed them to Deuteronomy 34 again, where it says Moses was 120 years old, and his eye wasn't dim, nor his strength abated. So there are all kind of jewels in there that you might use, but the biggest one is the gracious character of God. And what is so true then of the Pentateuch, I'll just tack in a New Testament text, is, you know, Jesus assumes and he understands that his mission is described fully in the Old Testament. When in the post-resurrection season that we're in now, he meets the Emmaus disciples and his own disciples, he doesn't point them to his experience in heaven already, but he opens the scriptures and explains from the Old Testament all the things concerning himself. These both occur in Luke chapter 24. And as he does so in his earthly ministry, he uses the Old Testament to explain what's happening. And I'll just highlight one or two of those. In Matthew 12, John the Baptist, a man of great faith, but in a weak moment says, "Are you the one who's coming, or do we look for another?" And Jesus says, "Tell John," he's in prison and he sends a disciple, and he tells the disciple, "Go back and tell John what you see and what you hear. The blind see, the lame walk, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news preached to them." These are all commentary on Isaiah 35, which was a great portrait of the messianic work and kingdom. So Jesus is continually reaching to the Old Testament to show his gracious actions. Or a favorite text I like is Luke 15, where Jesus says, "There is joy in heaven over one sinner who repents." Think about how significantly that underscores each and every human being. Instead of being marginal, as our culture wants to say men and women are, there is joy in heaven over one soul that comes to confess Christ and to worship the Trinity and the God of the Bible. Once in a while, there's a seminary student who hasn't done his homework, and I'll say, Professor, could you not call on me today? And I say, "You sinner, repent. I'm sorry. Then I say, "Well, there's joy in heaven over one sinner who repents."